Oh, goodness. So we decided to play the music. I do like the music in the middle of the show here. I do have an announcement, and that is that at clariters.com/yada.htm, for the next 30 days, there's going to be a 15% discount on each of the three books. And the author of the books gets absolutely nothing from the proceeds, so don't look to me for why they are priced as they are. I actually think that, considering the length of the book, they're priced unbelievably cheaply. A 1,200 to 1,500-page book, if it were a short-run textbook, would cost $200 to $400. And these books are priced at $39.95, so I think they are a tremendous value. But the designer of the artwork for the covers, Kirk, gets nothing from them. I get nothing from them. We do it as a labor of love and as a means for those of you who would prefer to read it in print as opposed to read it from your computer screens, which we offer it free, to have the ability to buy them. And I'm delighted with the way they have turned out. The site that will take you, the page that will take you, to directly to the books is clariters.com/yada.htm. So /yada.htm. And if you enter the promo code YADA15, you'll get a 15% discount below the $39.95 per volume purchase price.
Terrific.
Okay, so that said, I got my first three volumes arrived here yesterday, and I love them, so I'm delighted. Larry, in the statement you were making, it's interesting that when trying to deal with a conflict between their belief and Yahweh's testimony, you, rather than challenging Yahweh, they decided to label you a false prophet. Is it possible to be a false prophet if you're quoting Yahweh's words?
No, that would be an impossibility. That's the problem they have.
Of course,
these are all just words they throw at you, and then
you wouldn't even be a prophet. Right. So, well, beyond the fact that you're not claiming to be a prophet, if all you're doing is quoting Yahweh's testimony, it's impossible to be a false prophet because Yahweh got every prophecy right.
Yeah.
So, you're not claiming to be a prophet, every prophecy and every statement you're making is accurate because all you're doing is quoting Yahweh. And what were you doing that was so offensive to the religion?
Yeah, I'm on pretty solid ground.
Yeah, I think so. The only thing that
you sent me an answer just a couple of emails.
Right. You could be charged with being a false translator. Yeah, you could be called a false translator. Here are the words. You look up the words, and if you can demonstrate that these translations are less plausible, less accurate than some other translation that you would propose, then you give me the basis for that, and we can discuss it.
And tell me what lexicon you're using.
What I would say on that basis is that make certain that you're not using only one lexicon. Make certain that you're considering a number of different lexicons, and make certain that you're looking at the actionable root of the word, the verbal root of the word that you're considering, the stems, the conjugations, and the moods for the verbs, and that you have looked at the basis of each word in terms of what it meant prior to being vocalized on the Shoah system by the rabbis. And
can I ask you something?
Comprehensive, then we're open for a discussion. Sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to ask you something. If I say Shabbat Bahayom Halal, and it's translated 7 is the promise during the day, Yom. I mean, I don't know what else I can get out of Yom.
Right.
I'll come to radiate your light. That's halal.
Right.
How could that be seven times a day I praise your righteous laws? I mean, there are certain things we can just look at and say, what? Why did they do that?
Right.
Why
right.
did they rewrite it?
That, right.
I mean, yeah. there's no way to screw that up. But then again, if you're trying to promote the idea that a Torah is law and that Yahweh needs praise, I guess you just lie and you just throw it in there.
Yeah. Where is the Hebrew word for law?
I don't know of any.
I don't know either. Right. And can you get from Torah, which is, according to Yahweh, is based on the verb yara, which means source from which guidance and direction flow, the source of teaching.
Like Jerusalem,
like Jerusalem. How do you get from Torah to law?
You go to King James.
Well, you can't. And they didn't even write Torah in there. It wasn't even misrepresentation of the Torah. The word Torah isn't even in there.
Right.
Halal.
And, of course, halal. Well, halal, like a lot of Hebrew words, have a variety of different shadings. You know, halal can mean arrogance. But there is a requirement. Halal's primary meaning is to radiate light. That is its primary meaning. And there's no question that's its primary meaning. Its secondary meaning can denote being lifted up in pride and being arrogant. But isn't the primary kind of responsibility of a translator to represent each statement in a manner that is consistent with the context and consistent with Yahweh's nature? So that if you're given a choice in a verb, like halal, to render the verb radiate your light or lift up your arrogance, which one would you choose?
There you go. Once again, you got to choose what the context is.
Well, it's pretty obvious to me. We're talking about Yahweh's light here.
Right. Mm-hmm. And those are the two options.
I don't see how you can screw that up.
No,
the point is, you just gave a lot of academic or, direction to how to, translate properly. And although that's true, when I look at a simple line like this, I'm thinking, wow, they just rewrote it.
Yeah.
Well, they got the word seven.
Could y'all's light be lifted up in pride?
Yeah, I don't know. But I would tell you that since halal means to reflect light, that's the reason why it's halal ben shakar. It's the reflected light of the rising sun, and Satan is always associated with the sun. Almost all of his religious guises are as the sun. That's the chief pagan deity in most religions, and he is lifted up with the arrogance. But he is. Light. He reflects Yahweh's light because he is light. He's a spiritual being.
Yeah.
And so it all fits.
Just a counterfeit light. That's all.
Right. But when we're saying hallelujah, the halal that is in hallelujah can either address
a radiant light
and arrogance or the primary meaning, which is to radiate light. And so it's pretty obvious to me that
yeah, certainly not lifting up an arrogance Yahweh.
No.
It's radiating Yahweh's light.
And quite frankly, having studied the word, I don't know how you get praise out of it unless what you're attempting to do is establish a religious deity.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's what I'm saying.
So
yeah, you spent Kirk a long time studying every word that was translated, worship, praise, all those kinds of religious terms.
Yeah.
And we didn't find any one of them where the primary verbal root or just the verb itself had a primary meaning that had anything to do with worshiping or with praising. And you get to a point where it is appropriate and consistent with the covenant Yahweh's testimony to reflect his light, his intent.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no point where you get to praising him or worshiping him, because if his goal was to create a being for the purpose of worshiping him, then he would be a deficient individual. He would be really pretty depraved.
Have ego problems.
A serious ego problem. And I don't know why people have such a tough time understanding that, but they do. A God who would create a being to worship him is grotesque. And this is a grotesque concept, to saying that God is so insecure, so demeaning, so reprehensible, so deficient, that he would create a being for the express purpose of worshiping him. I mean, I don't even know how you get there and you think that that is a attribute that you would want in a deity, that you'd even want to know.
Well, it's probably an attribute they want.
Even word is Yahweh say he's a religious deity. He doesn't even say he's a deity.
No, of course. No.
He never says that.
Put yourself in this position, or Larry, I'll put you in the position. You know, if you had the capacity to create life, but since you don't, let's put you in the position where, since you don't have the capacity to create life, that you have the capacity to influence life. And that you created, through indoctrination, a slug, which is about the difference in mental capacity and character between us and Yahweh. You created a slug. And you trained not only a slug, but a billion slugs. You trained a billion slugs, and you created this slug farm for the express purpose of burping out and sliming out many times a day praise. Oh, praise for the slug farmer. Oh, slug farmer, you are the great one. Oh, we worship you, oh, slug farmer. Now, how many times would you have to have these slugs?
Yeah, you might do that.
No, you had. Now, okay, now you might laugh, you know, a few times. That's pretty funny. Come over here and listen to this. You aren't going to believe this. Okay, so as a joke.
Yeah, right.
You know, for giggles, you might laugh at it. Okay, but after you've had the slug, say, "Oh, Larry, oh, great one. We praise thy name, O Larry." In fact, in this case, it would be, "We praise thy name, O disgusting one," because they don't know your name. And they don't know who you are. Oh, you are so praiseworthy. We haven't got a clue who you are. But we're just going to burp this out all day.
Imagine you did.
Yeah, that'd be brilliant. That's called
that'd be worth. I tell you, that. Yeah, and that joke would be worth diminishing a part of yourself so you could be spit on and laughed at by the slugs. I mean, it would be worth it just to hear that.
Yeah, could you imagine then getting the slugs, assuming slugs can see, and I'm not sure a slug can see, and giving a slug, I'm not sure a slug has a conscience, and in fact, I doubt they do, and therefore can be discerning. But can you imagine giving the slugs the Larry Manifesto? The means for slugs to be like you, so that your goal would be to take these slugs and make these slugs like you. You give them a manifesto to make them like you.
Like you got to crawl down this path.
Right.
Well, that would be to get to know them.
And then you had such love for these slugs that you decided that you would become a slug. To relate to the slugs could create graven images of Larry, and they're going to create graven images of the Larryinator nailed to a pagan cross and being tortured with a crown of thorns. Sounds appealing to me.
Lovely.
How about to you? Yeah.
It'd all be
and
worth
then,
the joke.
Right, and then they're going to take the mother of the Larryinator and call her the Queen of Heaven and Mother of God. And then they're going to take to the Larryinator. Yeah, you'd really be a pretty swell guy. You know, you'd remind me at that point of Joseph Smith, of the uh, of a guy that's going to create a religion for the express purpose of swindling people out of their property and their and being able to control them. Now, how are you at that point any different than Muhammad?
Well, you're not.
You're not. A God who would create a being and to worship him is not worth knowing.
That's right. Yep. That's right. I've said it 1,000 times. I mean, you know, you get into, when you're on FB, you're going to get all kinds of people that friend you, and they're reading your notes, and they love you to death, and then they realize you're not on the same page with them.
Yeah.
And they get very angry. And if you take the Messianics as an example, they'll get on your page and they'll start saying, like, yeah, you people that worship the wrong God. And then you say, well, you know, if there's any worship associated with some deity, you know, this is Yahweh. He doesn't accept worship. And yeah, suddenly their heads turn around 17 times, you know, and all this. And they just don't understand you anymore. You know,
yeah, well,
and that's because
that bothers me about
it, you just don't understand Yahweh's
perspective. Why would you focus, why would you even associate yourself with a title that Yahweh never uses?
Mm-hmm.
I've searched the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. Yahweh never uses HaMashiach as a title. Even Mashiach, he uses it 22 times as a name. But there isn't a single occurrence anywhere in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms where HaMashiach is used as a title. Mashiach is used the best we can tell, since it's not in the Dead Sea Scrolls. The two places it appears in Daniel, neither of those are extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Not in Daniel.
Yeah, but see, neither of those two are extant in the Dead Sea Scrolls. So all we have is the Masoretic. And in the Masoretic, Mashiach is used as adjective to modify messenger. And it is a messenger who is set apart and prepared to convey the message. And that's what Mashiach is used as. But it isn't in any place ever presented as Messiah. Messiah. Never once is it Messiah. And never once is Mashiach even presented as a title. And there's a reason for that. And the reason, I think, is extraordinarily clear. It's the reason why I'm not focused on Yahusha. You know, first of all, his name is a billion times more important than his title. He didn't say, I came in the title that that Gabriel provided Daniel, did he?
No.
No. No. What did he say? I came in...
No. Came in my father's name.
Right.
Pretty sure.
Was his father's name Mashiach?
No.
Nope.
I don't think so.
No.
Yahweh.
Right.
So he came in his father's name. So now we're dealing with Yahusha. But even the name Yahusha on a 1 to 10 scale of importance may not even be a 1.
It's just the one.
It may not even be a 1.
Man.
Well,
yeah,
it's important in that Yahweh saves. And
yeah, he didn't say,
important.
I came in my name. He said, I came in my father's name. So why not look at the father's name?
Do you recall, maybe it was a year and a half ago or something, we did a show together on Yahweh's physical manifestation.
Yes.
And right in there, Yahweh says, don't focus on that. You know, this is in Yashayah. I got a whole note on it where he says, focus on my overall spiritual endeavors. That would be like, you know, Pesach to Sukkah, you know, type of thing. And yet, you know, we've got people that are so delusional that they just can't take their eyes off and look at the big picture. And if they're not doing that, I mean, if their sole focus, if their even their major focus is on witness writings, and all of us know that most of those witness writings are just beyond repair. They're so butchered.
Right.
But if that's
Luke
sole
and
focus,
Mark, with the only thing that has some credibility is Joseph's testimony and Matanyah, because even though Yael Conan was an actual eyewitness, Yael Conan has been badly butchered by religious scribes. So you really don't have a lot. And even in Matanyah, you've got to convert the Greek back into Hebrew if you're going to understand it. And so it's a lot of work. I mean, I happen to I cannot diminish the importance of Matanyah, because I think that Matanyah provides a marvelous perspective. I think it's like Dabadim. I think it's like Dodo.
It destroys Paulos.
Well, of course. But and for that, it's worth it. And but it's also just like Dodo's Psalms and Moshe's Dabadim in the Torah. It provides yet another affirmation that of how to properly evaluate, observe, come to understand, and act upon the Torah. So it's just like the primary source of information is the Torah. But if you are equipped with the 119th Psalm, you are infinitely better prepared to understand the Torah than if you don't have the 119th Psalm. If you take the Dabarim, which is Moshe's summation of what the Torah conveyed and how it applies to us, if you take Dabarim out, you can understand everything you need to know about the Torah just from the first three books. From Bereshit, which presents the covenant, from Shemot, Exodus, which presents the path to freedom that Yahweh has established, and the ten statements that he etched in stone, and then Korah,
the invitation
to be called out, Leviticus, which presents not only the path to walk to Yahweh and engage in his family and live with him in his home, but also presents the Yobel, which explains Yahweh's timing and purpose in that regard. Those three books, by themselves, are sufficient to be directed to Yahweh. However, that said, I think, and Yosha seemed to agree, because he quoted the Dvarim more than any other book in the Torah, that Moshe's first person narrative,
which is right,
that's
not
correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. That Moshe's insights, like Dodo's insights, which were inspired on how to properly observe the Torah and what you should focus on and what it means and what your response ought, I think is an extraordinarily effective and important tool. Can you get there without it? Yes.
Well,
but if you add it to the mix, it's just another perspective, another lens, another tool, another light.
You know what? And it's an affirmation, because there's a lot of prophetic stuff in there. But I have to say, when I look at Torah today, I look at the Tanakh. I mean, that to me, that's Torah, because it's teachings, it's guidance, it's instructions. You know, I mean, it's all there. I mean, you cannot read the 119th and say that's not instructive. You know, guys.
Yeah,
I mean, that's instructive.
Well,
every bit of it
is
Torah.
Yeah. So if I were to go back to the
that's my opinion.
Yeah. So if I were to go back to Matanyah. That's a witness writing, but Yosha's testimony in Matanyah, particularly the first chapters 3, 4, or actually 5, 6, and 7, when Yosha was referring to the Torah and prophets and said that nothing would change, that he did not come to annul them, that he didn't come to do away with them, and that not a single stroke of a single letter and the Torah and prophets would cease to exist so long as the heavens and earth cease to exist. Did he distinguish between the Torah and prophets, or did he use a singular pronoun when referring to the Torah and prophets?
Singular
pronoun.
Can I share one quick thing, Jim?
Sure.
I was listening. We went to the grocery store, and there was Dennis Prager. I hadn't heard him for years. He's, you know, a Jewish gentleman. He has his Yale in the university now and all kind of stuff. And so the question came to me.
I kind of like Dennis. I know who he is.
But
I used to listen to him a lot.
He's attractive. I like his practicality. But what he said today was kind of interesting. The caller came in and asked him what Torah should I read? And he quoted the one he could read, and he says, and this one is, but this one doesn't have Leviticus or Devarim in it. I
have
to fill out three of them.
What?
That was his favorite one. He said, I suggest this one. And he told him, he said, it has, and which ones it has, and it doesn't have Leviticus in it, and it doesn't have Devarim in it. I thought that was weird.
So you would throw away the heart of the Torah?
Well, yeah.
Why would you throw away the heart of the Torah?
The meaning, the path to get to Yahweh.
Well, you know,
that's strong.
I used to listen to him years ago down
strong
in Chile. You know, so it's so I.
What didn't Yahweh say? Don't add to the Torah and don't subtract from it.
Yeah, that's a big subtraction, I would think.
Well, that's a big chunk taken away.
When does it say that Moshe finished the Torah?
At the end of Devarim. Or finished the Torah.
Yeah, at the end of Devarim, right? It talks about, and Moshe finished the Torah, and he had the written copy of it. And then what does it say that the written copy of the Torah, where does it say the written copy of the Torah goes?
It goes right next to the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. And how long is the written copy of the Torah, which Moshe finished at the end of Devarim, where does it, how long is it supposed to be associated with the mercy seat?
Olam.
Forever.
Olam, yeah. So you can't subtract. God said, "Don't take anything away from it." And this fellow would say, "Oh, let's just take Leviticus and Devarim away from it." And Devarim. Great. All right. You know, I'm going to assume.
Well, that's just right.
I'm going to weigh on a limb here. My assumption is that the Torah contains five or six books, and because Yosha completed the Torah too. We're told in the book of Yosha, which is the sixth book, that Yosha completed the Torah. That he continued to write the Torah. So I'm going to go under the assumption that Yahweh provided exactly as much instruction, no more or no less, in the Torah than was necessary for us to come to know him and engage in a relationship with him. And that he, as the creator of the universe and the author of life, is in a pretty good position to know how much teaching would be ideal for us.
Well, if we could have had Yosha's collection of Yosha's words in Hebrew by one of the people who was sitting there, like Matthew, writing, that would have been a treasure. That would have been number seven, I think.
Yeah.
Then we'd have a good seven. We'd have six plus one.
Yeah, and I'm. By the way, I'm.
We don't.
I'm not opposed to that. I don't think that, personally. That's how I read Yosha's testimony in Matanya.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how I read it. But that's. I'm not trying to sell anybody on that.
No, that's
just my personal. It's something that resonates with me. It's always resonated with me. And so that's my perspective. But again, I have no justification for that other than just a gut feel. But part of this, keep in mind, is that I have a very different, I have a Larry and Yosha perspective on Torah. I view Torah as a singular thing. And I view that all of Torah is prophetic. And that all of Torah instructs, and therefore the Torah is the Torah, prophets, and Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Torah is entirely prophetic all the way through the process, and all of the prophets are provide instruction and direction.
Mm. There's a lot of prophecy there, yeah.
So I just personally view it as, I'm going to use the English and say Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but I'm saying that as a singular entity, which is how Yosha meant it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the writing...
Yeah, there's one other thing that's kind of important, that, I mean, to point out,
right?
You know, even though, you know, we know that the most accurate is Montaigne, what I'd still want to point out is that what is read in a religious book today has a lot of just add-ins out of whole cloth. You know, like the story of the who was without sin,
That's not in Matanya.
Okay, well,
that was added to the eighth chapter of Yahochanan, what it does is point out that Yao Kanan.
Yeah,
well,
that's
Yao
right.
Kanan,
Yao Kanan.
I am absolutely
just threw it
certain.
In there.
Yeah, I'm absolutely certain that Yao Kanan is trustworthy. I'm absolutely certain that there was there may have been only one or two people, and in the past 2,000 years that are as trustworthy as Yao Kanan. I think Shimon Kefesh, I think Matanya was probably in that. Yaakov was probably in that group. But over the past 2,000 years, you could limit it to two or three people that would be as trustworthy as Yao Kanan. And Yao Kanan, of course, was the scribe of Revelation. That being the case, my issue isn't with Yao Kanan. It's that first he or someone
is translating
Yosha's testimony from Hebrew into Greek. And we know that because his testimony was so popular, because he spends so little time on Yosha's life and so much time on the spiritual revelations that Yahweh revealed, that because he already had a copy of Matanya that did a marvelous job of delineating Yosha's words and deeds, what he did is he filled in the parts that that Matanya did not share. So it's a continuation, really, a supplement to Matanya's eyewitness account. The problem is that it was so well liked that it was the most edited. And that's the reason why, for example, the story of he that was is without stone cast without sin cast the first stone, and that line and that whole episode with the adulterous woman, the oldest manuscript it appears in is 8th century, and in 100% of the manuscripts prior to the 8th century, it does not exist. There's 12 statements that are 12 verses in English Bibles that for the first 8 centuries it does not appear. Was absolutely made up. And so you have to be really careful when you're looking at what's called those witness writings. And another example is that in Matanya and in Mark. Now, Mark is dealing, of course, with the testimony from Shimon Kefesh, and the Matanya was an eyewitness. And in both of them, they're talking about the celebration of Pesach. And in the context of Pesach, Yosha says that this is symbolic of the covenant. And yet in Luke, who was the scribe for Paul, it says this is symbolic of the new covenant. And so you have two eyewitnesses that say it's symbolic of the covenant, and you have a guy who was not there whose testimony is quite different, and says it was the symbol of the New Testament. And so you'd have to ask, who is more likely to be right? The guy that's different from the other two, when the other two was eyewitnesses, and the guy who was different wasn't even within 1,000 miles of the place where it was said.
I'll try that. The eyewitnesses who were actually there would probably be more dependable than the historian of Paulos.
Right. Now, would you also then maybe toss in the idea that the only reference to a renewed covenant is in Yirmiyah, and in Yirmiyah, he's speaking of dealing with reconciling his relationship with Yisrael and with Yehudah. Now, at when he's celebrating this Pesach, which is less than 12 hours from the time that he is going to be flailed alive, going to be mocked and spit upon, going to be nailed to an upright pole at the urging of Yisrael and Yehudah, would you say there's a possibility that the relationship with Yisrael and Yehudah was resolved and reconciled at that point?
Nope. It sure wasn't.
Sure wasn't.
Not
so
even
is it possible that of course, would be consistent?
You know how I look at that.
With Yirmiyah's discussion of the time of the renewal? And, oh, by the way,
the time of the renewal
was the Torah written inside of Yisrael or Yehudah at that time? Is the Torah written inside of,
no. They were fully
Israel
opposed to it.
Today.
Fully opposed to it, actually.
No, they're still opposed to it.
Yeah, they're fully opposed to it. You know.
Yeah, here's Dennis Prager saying, you know. Yeah.
But you know what I would say? Would you go
drop two of the
you're on my Yahoo. You know, when you of course go under 31:31 there where you're talking, it says. What's going to happen to the people that have chosen him? Well, the Torah is going to be written inside of them. So the idea that a Torah was, you know, nailed to some pagan cross is ridiculous. And when I look at that word, which is Chadesh, I liken it, especially in that particular passage. When I look at that, I say to myself, it's like, okay, I'm walking down the road, and the heel broke off on my shoe. And I take it to a shoe repair man, and he repaired it. I didn't walk into Dillard's and buy a new set of shoes.
No.
And that's what's going on there. One's repaired, restored, renewed. The other one's something that's foreign. It would have to be foreign.
Well, let's get some further evidence.
That's just the way it is.
Did Yahweh tell...
Mm-hmm.
Abraham, that his children would go astray. Did he tell them that?
No.
Did Yahweh vow to Abraham that he would eventually reconcile his relationship with his descendants?
Mm-hmm. Yes, he absolutely did.
Yeah, he did, didn't he?
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
And is all of that chronicled in the Torah?
Yes.
Okay, it is, huh? All right.
Yeah.
So,
sure is.
So when Yahweh is speaking of renewing and reestablishing this covenant, did he ever create anyone other than the one that he's established with Abraham? And is he doing exactly what he told Abraham?
Promised Abraham
he would do.
Probably.
There's no second covenant ever mentioned, and he's doing exactly what he told Abraham he was going to do with his descendants based upon the original covenant. And so you can't get a new covenant.
Yeah, that's exactly straightforward thinking, Yada.
Right.
That's why we love you.
But then you also look at the fact that the difference between the existing covenant and the reaffirmation of the covenant is that he is placing a comprehensive and perfect version of the Torah inside of us that becomes part of the fabric of our lives. Doesn't the Torah speak of just one covenant?
Mm-hmm.
So how could you have a new covenant based on the existing Torah?
It's impossible.
The whole thing is so preposterous. It's stunning that a religion grew out of this.
It's stunning that after you explain that to somebody, they still adhere to it. That's what's stunning.
I talk to somebody that tells me that, well, you know, Yosha spoke of a new covenant, and I'll point out, well, there are three accounts. Two were eyewitnesses. The other wasn't within 1,000 miles of the place. And so if you have two that agree and one that does not agree, and that the one that does not agree was not an eyewitness and wasn't even in proximity of the place, which one do you think which ones are trustworthy and which ones are not? But the next thing I'll say is, what was the context? What was the context? When he said this is the covenant, this is symbolic of the covenant, when you do these things, I want you to remember the connection between me and the covenant. When he said that, what was he doing?
Pesach.
Pesach. That's what he was doing. He was celebrating Pesach. Where do you learn about Pesach?
The Torah.
In the Torah. And then I will always ask the Christian, are you observing Pesach? Do you attend Pesach? He was celebrating Pesach. He said all of this in conjunction with Pesach. Do you understand it in conjunction with Pesach? Do you answer Yahweh's invitation to attend Pesach? And of course they'll say no. And I said, then why are you asking me when you have no idea what he said in the context that he said it? It's not hard. It gets right back to the thing that you were talking about earlier. You want to translate Yahweh's testimony. Read it in context. render it in a manner that is consistent with what he has told us and who he is and what he's offering. And if you do that, you'll be right far more often than you're wrong. So here's the Yobel. I know this is stated in a book that Dennis Prager says that you don't need. Personally, I rather...
Not his favorite.
Thank you, Dennis.
He recommends the other one.
I will tell you that I do have a favorite of the five books in the Torah, and it's not the Budim. That's my... I would say the Budim is probably my my... third favorite. You know my favorite book of the Torah by a million miles, by light years.
No, the first one.
No, Bar-Rashid in the beginning. I think it's my favorite because I love the creation story and its affirmation in science. I love the story of Noah and its affirmation of the covenant and how to listen to what Yahweh has to say and act upon it. I love the story of my favorite story in the entirety of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms is the story of Abraham and the creation of the covenant relationship. And so that is my favorite book by a million miles. If I never ever went beyond that, and I think that the 7+1 plan is beautifully laid out in Bar-Rashid, and I think that the notion that Yahweh created us to have a relationship like he had in Eden, and in year 6,000 to 7,000 Yahweh will be back in Eden, I think it's really all laid out, how Satan operates, how religions operate, where Satan slithered into the garden and took Yahweh's testimony out of context and twisted it, as religion does, to create a false impression. I just see most everything you need to know is in Bar-Rashid.
Yeah, if that was all you had, you could
be all right.
Yeah,
you could be there.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not discarding. No, mind you, I'm not discarding the rest. I'm just telling you that's my favorite of the books. That's my favorite.
All right, with you.
Yeah, here's the first mention of Yobel. The first mention of Yobel is not actually in Kara, Leviticus, where the Yobel is described at great length. The first mention happens to be in Shemot's names. And what's interesting is it appears prior to the presentation of the 10 instructions that Yahweh etched in stone. It appeared really very close to that, but right before it. So Yahweh is providing a perspective for which we can understand and view the 10 statements that he etched in stone, which follow this. He said, with the drawing up and extension of Ha-Yobel, the Yobel, the ram's horn of Yah, they should of their own volition choose to genuinely ascend and be lifted up in association with this mountain. So that's a mouthful. That is from Shemot's names, Exodus 19:13. So the first verb is ba-masach, so with the drawing up and the extension. So the masach means following this guidance, following the leadership of the Yobel. The Yobel is, I think, is extremely instructive into Yahweh's timing. It's 7 times 7+1, the promise of the Shabbat, plus 1. The plus 1 is always God. So 7 times 7, 49, plus 1 is the period of time. It's instructive as it relates to Yahweh's timing, but it is mostly instructive in terms of the purpose of the Yobel. The purpose of the Yobel, according to Kara, invitations to meet with God and be called out, is to liberate slaves, which is what Yahweh does in Exodus, right? In Shemot, liberates us from the crucible of Egypt, and it's the whole purpose of the path that we walk to. It's the whole purpose of the covenant is walking away from the enslaving institutions of man to freedom in Yahweh's family and home. And so the Yobel is about freeing slaves. That's why the Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim in Shavuah is about liberation from human institutions and slavery. But the second thing is that just as Matzah is about the forgiveness of for the things that are responsibility that encumber us, the Yobel is about forgiving all debts. All debts are forgiven. So Yahweh in the Yobel presents the purpose of his plan of relationship and of reconciliation through his stated objectives in the Yobel. Now, there's a third aspect to the Yobel. The two biggies are all slaves are freed. We go from enslavement in human institutions to total freedom in Yahweh's company. And the second is that all debts are forgiven. We become perfected. There is a third aspect of the Yobel. You know what the third aspect is, guys?
Yep, the ram's horn.
Well, it's called the Lamb's Horn of Yah. That's the name of it. And so there's all the associations with the lamb that was, the ram that was caught in the thicket by its horns, Karin, which radiate light on Mount Moriah when Abraham and Jacob were there. And Yahweh said, do not take your son because I will provide the sacrifice. And so that is the Passover sacrifice on Mount Moriah. The name designates that, but the Yobel itself does a third thing. All land is returned because Yahweh says, the land is mine. All land is returned because Yahweh says, the land is mine. So we are returned to his realm on the Yobel if we avail ourselves of his liberation and his forgiveness. We get to return to his realm, and his realm is Yisrael in a perfect condition, mirroring Eden, the garden of great joy. And so if you view Yisrael as a metaphor for Yahweh's home and as presented effectively in the story of Eden, you will know where we are being returned. And so what happens in year 6,000.
Oh, well, yeah, that too. That too. But I mean, clearly, in the 50th year, the land always returned back. And by the way, that really would put an end to all theft, wouldn't it?
And
dynasty building.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, it's true that men can own property around the world, but according to the Torah, you can't amass beyond 50 years large land holdings because the land isn't, this universe doesn't belong to us. It belongs to Yahweh. Now, once we return home to Yahweh, then it becomes ours again. But it becomes ours again because we inherit it from him. Mm-hmm. It's our inheritance as part of the covenant. But our inheritance, we can inherit it from him because he owns it and we're returning to him as part of the Yobel. So all of those things are communicated by the Yobel. So when this says to Masak, the Yobel, it says, follow the guidance of the Yobel and follow the leadership of the ram's horn of Yah. The guidance of the Yobel is profound. You know, we have the ram. We have the ram representing Yah. This is the sacrificial Passover lamb of Yahweh. This is Yahusha. We have the association with the ram's horn as of the affirmation of the covenant on Mount Moriah with Abraham and Yahweh and Yitzhak. We have 2,000 or 40 Yobel later, the sacrificial lamb of Yahweh, Yosha, fulfilling Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim on the same mountain. We have all debts being forgiven. We have total liberation from human servitude. And we return home as a result of it. That's a lot of guidance.
And by the way, just to digress a little bit there, mm-hmm. You asked had the covenant been renewed yet? Well, there's still slavery.
Yes.
There's still debts owed.
Yes.
There's still all these things. And when the Yobel is complete, there's none of these things.
Jews mostly socialist, secular humanists?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Are most Jews agnostic?
Most of them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are the Jews that are not agnostic religious and tied up into their Talmud?
Very much so.
Did Yosha demean the Talmud? What did Yahweh say in Hosha about Yisrael? Didn't he say, I'm divorcing you?
Mm-hmm.
I'm divorcing you based upon,
I mean, I could
based
go
upon infidelity? Right. And didn't he say that in on the third day he would heal them so that that on the 2 days thereafter that the relationship would be reconciled? Didn't he give us the timing for all of this?
Yeah, the day being 1,000 years and 1,000 years a day. That's 40 yovel from the sacrifice.
Right.
Sure.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Right
so
there.
So he gave us. So we know that in Hosha that Yahweh divorced Yisrael. And he said that he would eventually divorce himself of Yahudah, but that Yahudah, there was work still to be done. So he divorced himself of Yisrael, which was Ephraim. And he said he still had issues with Yahudah, but there was some healing to be taken care of. You know, he was going to come as Yahusha.
Come and do it.
Through Yahusha. And then he said it would be 2,000 years. And so we don't have a reconciliation of the divorce with Yisrael. And, you know, the Christian church doesn't qualify. No, the Christian church does not qualify.
No,
he did not say that, you know, in 3 days I'm going to create, in 3 days I'm going to create my church. So this is extremely straightforward. So with the drawing up and the extension, following the guidance and leadership of the ram's horn of Yah, they should, of their own volition, always and genuinely choose to ascend by being lifted up. So if you want to be lifted up by Yahweh, you should choose of your own volition to follow the guidance that's being provided by the Yobel.
And that's why they came to a church.
Right. So would you, if you want to follow the guidance that is provided by the Yobel, wouldn't you have to read what's now called the 25th chapter of Kata, Leviticus?
Mm-hmm.
And there's only a handful of places you can learn about the Yobel. You're told how important it is here in the Torah in the 19th chapter of Shemot, Names, Exodus. Every aspect that's important of it is then delineated right after Yahweh delineates the path to him in Kara, Leviticus 23. He focuses on the Yobel in Kara, Leviticus 25. And so that's the second place. The third place you can learn about the purpose of the Yobel is when Yashayah, which we're just going to go to in a moment here, when Yashayah helps to explain it prophetically. And Yashayah is not doing it. Yahweh was doing it through Yashayah. And then there's a fourth place that you can go to gain a perspective on the Yobel, and that's when in Matanyah, Yosha is shown walking into the synagogue on the Sabbath, as was his custom, and he opened the scroll of Yashayah to the place where he began to read about the Yobel and saying, hey, folks, this is being fulfilled in me.
Why do people have so much trouble when you're told this and you know there's one more Yobel to come in this generation?
Yeah.
Why do prophecy people who generally study hard, I know they do, I used to be one of them, why do they have such a hard time
coming up
with it? Is it just why don't they read this?
Yeah,
I mean, you can extrapolate.
Well, the question I've always had is, why do they go right to Daniel? They go to Daniel, and Daniel's talking about something completely different. And they all have to go to it to say, this is the return. And, of course, you know, these clowns that do it, it's always at midnight. You know, like, Yahweh's got a clock that starts at midnight.
What's amazing is Daniel, Yosha, it's actually Gabriel, is providing insights to Daniel. And by the way, why would you think that Yahweh speaks in first person to virtually every prophet, but he sends Gabriel to speak to Daniel? Are you guys talking about that? Why is Daniel the only prophet where Yahweh sends one of his messengers to speak for him versus the others? Yahweh speaks directly to them where they are, and they just write down what Yahweh says.
Well, he did have something to do with it. Where
was maybe where was Yahweh's spirit?
Where was Daniel?
Babylon. Yahweh's spirit in Babylon.
Where's the place
Babylon.
Babylon wants to take us away from that Yahweh wants nothing to do with?
Babylon. Wow.
Interesting.
Right.
That's why.
Exactly.
That would have been my thought.
Yeah, that's why he sent Gabriel. So, with Gabriel, he's telling Gabriel, he says, you know, he says, from the time of the decree to return and to rebuild the city. And then he gives a specific number of years. And so the first thing you have to do is you have to look up and say, okay, this was the 20th year of Artaxerxes in his realm when this was given. So you have to look up and say, when did he come to power? And what you found is he comes to power in 444 BCE. And then once you do that, you simply do the math, and you multiply the number of years that we're told by the number of the prophetic year, which is 360 days, and you come to 4 days before Pesach in what we would call year 33 CE. And I think that the Christians who study prophecy have a tough time with that because it's 4 days before Pesach. And they don't understand, why would it be 4 days before Pesach? Because when does the Passover lamb come into the home?
When they broke in the gate, or they come to the home.
4 days.
4 days before Pesach. Mm-hmm. And so the day is 4 days before Pesach in year 4000, which is 33 CE, and 4 days later he becomes the Passover lamb. But if you're a Christian studying eschatology, you can't associate him with Pesach. You can't associate him with the Torah's instructions on 4 days before Pesach because, guess what? That lamb can't be resurrected. I mean, that lamb is fulfilling the heart of the Torah.
And no one has seen that and had enough guts to say, you know, this is wrong, guys.
Right, and so what does that get you? That gets you to 33.
Well, they get kicked out of their little school.
Right. And so that occurred in 33 CE, and they all know the timeline of, they all know that Yahweh's favorite number is 7, and they all know that we're really close to what would be year 6000 Yah, and they all know that he has to return during the generation that saw Yisrael be reestablished. And by the way, why would Yisrael being reestablished mean anything if their church replaced Yisrael? I don't want to think about that one. But saw Yisrael established, and that if it happened in 33 CE, you know, why not make the connection with the Yobel? And every time that Yahweh speaks of a time of testing, it's always 40, and multiply the Yobel by 40, and you get to
2033.
The only Yobel year left within the time of the generation. And it's not just a Yobel. It's exactly 40 Yobel from the time of the sacrifice. How tough is it to come up with that date?
It's simple as long as you observe the Torah, which they don't.
Right, right. And if you're open to...
it's simple
as guidance.
As long as you understand what a Yobel is. You know, how many people even know what a Yobel is? I mean, we get outside this group and start talking in terms of Yobel. I'm telling you, I have yet to find one that understands a Yobel.
But they know
it's a major issue, which is why we're talking about it tonight.
In Kara Leviticus 25, I'm telling you that if the heart of the Torah is the Mikra, which is the basis of Kara anyway, the basis of the book, if that's the heart of it, is the invitation that Yahweh has provided for us to walk to him and become perfect and to camp out with him for all eternity, and it's emblazoned for all time as it was lived in the dress rehearsal of Shemot Exodus during the Yahweh's freedom, of taking his children to freedom, as he promised Abraham he would do as part of the covenant, if you have something of that importance that's immediately followed by all debts being forgiven, all slaves being free, and it follows, Yahweh says, I am Yahweh God who freed you from the crucible and from being slaves, why would you put those pieces all together? Make the connection. And then how tough is it to see that there's a Passover lamb of God?
No cud to chew it.
Yeah, I guess so.
You got the same problem with rabbinics. You got the same problem with rabbinics. They don't even want to admit that there's a, you know, year of the lamb, basically.
Oh, of course.
Let's get the lamb out of the story here.
No, they don't celebrate the Yobel. The last Yobel they celebrated was 133 AD. And you know why the last, where they celebrated 133? They knew of Yahweh's 6 plus 1 plan. Rabbis were talking about it all the time. And they knew that it was year 4000, is what they thought. Yeah, absolutely. And so they thought it was year 4000. And so Rabbi Akiva says, oh, we screwed up, so let's name a Messiah. It's got to be time. The whole thing fits together.
Let's name a Messiah.
And let's call that Messiah, son of a star. See how well that works for us. And let's pick a guy that's a vicious warlord.
Yeah.
And then I will dictate that he is the Messiah, and that'll really torque Rome off. And then we'll be crucified as a people. We'll be hauled off into captivity. They'll rename Yehuda Philistina. They'll salt the earth, and those of us that are not hauled off into slavery will be crucified. That'll work out really good. And then based upon my stupidity, they'll call me the father of a new religion. The Akiva story is as dumb as Pauline Christianity. So this last part says, of their own volition to always choose to ascend and be lifted up in association with this mountain. This mountain. What mountain is he talking about?
All right.
Yeah. Well, no, not right now. No, not right now. He's going to talk about
Horeb.
Yeah, right now he's talking about Horeb, Mount Sinai. Who's there at Mount Sinai?
Moshe and the Torah.
Yes,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, Moshe, Yahweh, the Torah. Yosha's there. Yeah, so if you want to be lifted up, then understand the Yobel in association with that mountain. That mountain is where Yahweh met with his people, where he liberated his people, where he educated and enlightened his people, where he liberated his family. That's what happened on that mountain. Now, you could argue, and I think successfully, that Horeb, Mount Sinai, is every bit as vital as Mount Moriah.
Hmm.
Yahweh reveals himself on Horeb. Mm-hmm. He explains himself on Horeb. He presents the covenant on Horeb. He delineates the instructions as to how to engage in the covenant with him on Horeb. He proclaims the invitations to meet with him and explains them on Mount Horeb. He proves that he's God on Mount Horeb. He liberates his children there, enlightens his children there.
Isn't that the mountain where he got Moshe?
Absolutely. Where he met with Moshe and said, tell the children of Israel that Yahweh has sent you to them. Yeah, exactly. So Mount Horeb is a rather important place. So because I want to keep Larry happy here, I'm going to turn to Larry's favorite book. Now, I have a favorite book. It's Bar Rashid. Larry, you have a favorite book. It's Yashaya. Wouldn't that be fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much, book? Yeah.
Yeah,
it would be fair to say it's not to the exclusion of anything else.
I'm not excluding anything. Okay. My favorite, if I were to pick one segment other than the Bar Rashid account of creation and the covenant, I'm pretty fond of the 119th Psalm. And I'm really fond of the 22nd Psalm and the 88th Psalm, and I'm really fond of Yashaya too. But I might even like Yirmiyah more than I like Yashaya. That is, you know, that's like saying that I like chocolate chip ice cream more than I like chocolate cake. That's not to suggest that I don't love chocolate cake.
Exactly right.
I will say, though, one thing that's where we're at.
Yashaya is so great is how prolific it is in the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right.
It's nice having that with Yashaya.
Yeah, with Yashaya, you have absolute and 100% confidence that you're getting it right. All right, so it says the redeeming one. This is how this begins. This is Yashaya 59, 20 and 21. The redeeming one, Ga'al, Ege'ulim, the kinsman and close relative who restores. And Ge'ulim would be plural. So the redeeming one is being presented here as a dual construct. Will come and enter Zion, the signpost along the way. Will come to Zion and come to those in Jacob who turn away from Shub rebellion, declares Yahweh. As for me, this is my covenant relationship with them, says Yahweh. And my spirit will be upon you. My words, I will by association and relationship place in your mouth, and they will not depart from the mouths of your offspring or your children's children, says Yahweh. Okay, so let's consider what he's saying. So the first thing is that Yahweh is saying that he is redeeming. To be redeemed, what does that mean?
Have to pay the price.
Yeah, somebody
pay the
pays the ransom, right?
Yeah.
To redeem. It's to buy you back.
Mm-hmm.
Yahweh has the currency to buy us back, doesn't he?
That's right.
Doesn't have to go to the bank. Doesn't have to use fiat money. Doesn't have to use money. He has the currency to buy us back. And that's what... It's redeeming is a much more comfortable term, I think, than the saving one. You know, Yasha is the saving one. I've got no problem with Yasha. You know, saving's fine, delivery's fine. But he didn't use Yasha here. He referred to himself as Ga'al. Now, Ga'al is the term that in Hebrew means to roll away. So he has the currency to roll away our iniquity, the division between us. And in those cases, the thing that's being rolled away, remember how he talks in the witness writings about the rolling away the stone that covered that separated the world from that tomb? And then when the children of Israel were on the wrong side of the Jordan and were looking up at Jerusalem, you know, it was right there, close enough to touch, but it was several thousand feet above them, and they're looking up to it, but they're on the wrong side of the Jordan. There, Yahweh said that there needed to be some Ga'al, some rolling away of iniquity before they could cross. And so that's what's happening here. To be redeemed means that the door, the stone that blocks the doorway is being rolled away, and with it, that part of us that is not welcome in Yahweh's home is rolled away. So that's what redeeming means. But the fact that this redeeming one is Ge'ulam means that he's a close relative. How about our father? A kinsman who restores. Will come to Zion. There are three mountains in Israel, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Zion's one of the three.
Right.
And he didn't say he's coming to Moriah here. He didn't say he was coming to Olives here, which is symbolic of the Spirit, and Moriah is symbolic of the covenant. He said he was coming to Zion. Now, that's not to say that he wasn't going to those other places. He will, and he did. But the emphasis here on redemption is Zion because that's the signpost along the way. So that presents Yahweh as the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, Yosha, as a sign along the way. Now, is the sign the destination? Or is the sign a delineator of the route and the path.
The latter.
Yeah.
No, it's a delineator. It's a signpost.
Yeah. And with something written on it that says, you know, go this way. This is the right way. You know, X number of steps further to go, and you'll be at your destination if you stay on this path. This is the right way. Was Yosha a Torah observant?
Completely.
Absolutely.
By the way, I just want to throw this in here. Yeah.
Yes, and if Yosha was not Torah observant, then he would not have fit the prophecy of the Messiah.
Right.
Simple as that. I mean,
you can't
get Yosha away from the Torah and even understand him.
Right. The Lamb has to be perfect.
You get into some area where you're, you know.
Yeah, the Lamb had to be perfect, and so he was perfectly Torah observant. But the fact is here that he is the signpost along the way because he himself was Torah observant. He walked that same path. He himself celebrated Pesach, Matzah, Bikurim, and Shavuot. He himself observed.
Could you say you were a follower of him if you didn't do those things? Could you?
No, of course not. No, I'd be lying if you did. Of course not. That's why there's no Christian in the world that follows Yosha. They don't know his name, and they don't follow his example, because his example was to celebrate and observe the Torah. And then it says here that that he will enter Zion and come to those in Jacob. Come to those in Jacob. What do you think? Why is he saying that he's going to come to those
in Israel?
Israel.
That's Israel, individuals
because
who engage and endure with God.
Jacob was the father of all of Israel.
That is correct. That is correct. And by saying Jacob, we have a individual that represents Yisrael, but also an individual who was tempted by Hasatan and who did not give in and chose Yahweh, and therefore was affirmed as the heir to the covenant. So Jacob is more than just Yisrael. The thing that makes, and that's big, I mean, I don't want to diminish that. Jacob is Yisrael, but he's more than Yisrael, and that Jacob is the very promise of the covenant. You know, the covenant is Abraham, Esau, and Jacob.
Right. You can't just say all these people. Yeah,
right. So when you're saying Abraham, Esau, and Jacob, you're talking about the covenant.
You're talking about
So it's the covenant.
Covenant family members certified with a stamp.
Right.
That's what you're talking about.
So he came to those
talking about people who happen to live in the land. You know.
Right. But now understand, though, it doesn't say that he just came to all of those in Jacob. No. He said he came to those in Jacob, which is in the covenant, who turn away from rebellion. Pesach. Rebellion, Pesach. And
bunch of fishermen, actually.
Right, yeah. What Pesach means in Hebrew, that's institutionalized rebellion. So what is institutionalized rebellion? I mean, there's lots of words for sin in Hebrew. This is not the word for sin. This is the word for institutionalized, broad-based rebellion.
It's totally
religion. It's religion and religion and politics, right there.
Right, that's what it is. There is that. That is what Pesha means. Declares the Lord. No. Declares Allah. No. Declares Jesus. No. Declares Christ. No. So who is the one who is the Redeemer, who's going to enter and become the signpost to those in the covenant with Jacob who turn away from institutionalized religion and politics?
Oh, it's Yahweh.
It's Yahweh. And by his own admission here. Then, what does Yahweh say? Just in case.
With the help of his Ruach, his spirit.
Right. So just in case you thought that there was a possibility that Yahweh was speaking of someone else, like Jesus. And just in case you were misguided and you thought that he was establishing a new and different religion based upon a new and different testament, what is the next thing he says? As for the other guy, no. As for the Lurianator.
My spirit.
Yeah, as for Kirk. No. As for me. So he's telling you, this is me. As for me, this is my new religion. This is my new testament. This is my Christianity. This is my church. What does he say? This is my covenant.
Then he says, bereaved. My family relationship.
This is my family.
Never established a religion.
I'm the kinsman redeemer who rolls away that which is blocking the entrance to my home, to me. And I'm going to come and enter the signposts along the way on behalf of those in Jacob, in the covenant, in the family, who have turned away from religion and politics, declares Yahweh. As for me, this is my covenant with them, says Yahweh. Didn't Yahweh say that he was going to do this on behalf of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Jacob?
Mm-hmm.
He said, this is my covenant.
I'm pretty sure he did. It was his oath. Yeah.
Did he say, this is my religion? No. Did he say, this is the means that you're going to use to worship me? This is the means that you should fear me?
No.
This is the means that, you know, I'm going to be wrathful? This is the means I'm going to change everything? This is the means I'm going to reach out to that scumbag Paul? No. This is my covenant. Did he say, this is my different covenant? I mean, can you imagine all the things you have to change to make this fit Christianity? Imagine.
Oh, well, that's one of the things that I find laughable. They want to dance on the pinhead on one word. Well, why don't you just rewrite the whole damn thing? You did anyway. I mean, that's the way I look at it. I mean, they know for a fact it's not based on or predicated on one word somewhere. It's the entire story from start to finish that has to be changed. And I think that's why their Old Testaments and their religious material that should all be burned, in my opinion, clouds the issue. Never once.
Now, speaking
rarely
of religious material,
a straight passage, and you know it, and so do I.
Right. Yeah. So here is, speaking of religious corruptions, the Dead Sea Scrolls had F between Bereth and Yahweh's name. And so, according to the oldest and complete manuscript of Yahshiyah, it says, as for me, this is my family with them, my home with them, my covenant with them, says Yahweh. The with, and the with was given the preposition, the pronoun them, plural, is essential to understanding what he's saying, that his redemption, his functioning as the signpost, him coming to those who understand what it means to be in Jacob, who turn away from religious and political rebellion, this is Yahweh's covenant with those individuals. And yet, the Masoretes removed F. So, there was no association between the covenant, Yahweh, and those individuals who accepted Yahweh as their redeemer, as who read the signs that he posted along the way, who recognized that he came to Israel on behalf of the covenant through Jacob, for those who turn away from religion. So the next statement is that my spirit will be upon you. Now, you have two different options here. I think they're both accurate. One is my spirit will be upon you in the sense of that Yahweh's spirit will be upon the redeeming one. And that's why Yelim was written in the plural. Geul is the singular. Geulim is the plural. So the fact that his ruach will be upon
that would be like
you,
the difference between El and Elohim.
Correct.
Mighty One and Mighty Ones.
Right,
wouldn't
right,
it?
Right, exactly. So
yeah,
by his name, my spirit will be upon you. He is now explaining why Redeeming One was presented as a duality. Because you have the physical manifestation of Yahweh plus the spirit of Yahweh. These are separate things that create the whole, but it's important to know that the spirit is separate from the body because the spirit will leave the body.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why spirit is singular, but the Redeeming One was written in a dual way. Now, I think there's something else that's true.
Yeah, that's clear.
And I think so, but I think there's a possibility of another accurate interpretation. And my spirit will be upon you. Now, isn't he saying the Redeeming One will come and enter the signpost along the way and will come to those in the covenant with Jacob who turn away from religious and political rebellion, declares Yahweh. As for me, this is my covenant with them, says Yahweh, and my spirit will be upon you.
Right.
So who's he? Who's the you?
Yeah.
I could be both.
Who's the you? Who's the you?
Those would be people that accept the covenant that aren't in rebellion.
But there you go.
My
spirit will be upon you. I think.
Well, he's saying more than one thing there, that's for sure.
That's what I think.
Absolutely.
That's what I think.
I think.
That's my. I'm not discounting the uniqueness of Yahweh's spirit being upon Yosha, which explains how this diminished manifestation could represent.
You pointed that out in Redeeming One.
Right. But
the Geulim.
But
you know,
the last thing is, it's the covenant relationship with them, and my spirit will be upon you. The you can absolutely apply to the covenant children, those in the family. My words will, by association and relationship, I will place in your mouth. Okay. Did Yosha cite the Yosha's testimony or Yahweh's testimony in the Torah?
Just like you do.
Yeah. All the time.
Yeah. All the time.
Yeah.
Sure.
And don't we do it all the time? Aren't we doing it right now?
Yes, sir.
Every chance we get. Right. In fact, did Yosha recite
that's what makes
passage?
Us trumpets, baby. Hey, trumpet
right.
man over there. That's
yeah.
that's Teruah.
Right. So, you know, if he's speaking of Yosha, that his words I will place by association in your mouth. Absolutely. Yosha was the mouth of Yahweh.
Yep.
But was he also talking about those of us who have come to know Yahweh as a result of his Torah and are citing his Torah? Aren't his words also in our mouths?
Well, just like Shimon Kevish.
Yeah, he says it in about 1 second here. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yes.
that's correct.
And they will not depart from the mouths of your offspring or your children, says Yahweh. Now, in this particular case...
Well, that's them.
Right. Now, since in this case, we should be children, the offspring of Yahweh, through his Redeeming One and his covenant... And we could be the offspring of the of Jacob, and that Jacob was the formalization of the covenant. And so you could look at this either of those two ways, but you have to be careful because these offspring, these children, that Yahweh's word will never depart from them. So at this point, he has to be moving ahead to his return and reconciliation, because it is at that point that his words never depart us. Now, for us, his words will never depart, but for the majority of the descendants of
all eternity.
At that time. All right.
That's fair.
Yep.
Yeah.
Does that tell you that, now, if these words, Yahweh's words, and he's really clear about this, if Yahweh's words, because Yahweh is speaking in first person, my words, will be by association be placed in your mouth, and they will not depart from the mouths of your offspring or your children's children, says Yahweh. If that is the case, and he says, from that time through all eternity, how do you come up with a New Testament?
Dead again.
Dead again. How do you come up with this idea that the Torah is equated to a dead husband, as Paul writes in Romans? Or that
it's pornography
and Galatians?
You come up through that by working to carry water for Hase.
Yeah, or he says, you know, why the Torah then? Well, you know, the Torah existed up until Yosha. Well, was Yosha, did Yosha mark the end of time? Did the world continue to go on after Yosha?
Yeah. Well,
I think it did. I mean, I think we're 2,000 years later. So I think it did. I'm pretty sure it did. And so it says that that Yahweh's words will continue to endure for all eternity. Under that basis, you can't have a New Testament that contradicts his testimony. It's just over.
Yeah, there was a very simple thing that you had written once. I'm trying to go back. One of the rules, this is straight up rule, and it has to be if you're rational, that if one passage contradicts another one, it can't be true.
Correct.
There you go. You know, Yahweh doesn't lie to people. I mean, he's straight up. You know, this is the real deal. So, if you want to go contradict him, well, what you're doing is not true. It's as simple as that.
Right. If his words are going to endure for all time, then he can't change them. You can't take something, you know, if I say that all wagons are red, and then I say, you know, I'm going to create a new wagon that is only blue and that red wagons are no longer valid, then my statement about wagons are red for all time would be invalidated. And therefore
it becomes a lie.
So
don't you think Christians, even rabbinic Jews, they're more comfortable with lies than they are the truth? They're more comfortable.
Oh, I think they are.
Yeah, we had somebody post in UT today where there was this kid that claimed he went to heaven and you know, he was like 6 or 7, not very old, but he made up this fantastical story of what happened to him while he was in heaven, and they actually published a book based on it. And then later the kid came out and admitted it was all a lie. Now, guess what happened? The Christians continue to buy his book. I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. He himself says it's a lie, and now they continue to buy the book. It's amazing.
It is so obvious what God intended, what he conveyed, what he wants us to know, what he's offering, what he's like. And it is the saddest thing about it is the combination of Yahweh in his own voice delineated these instructions, this guidance for us. And then he himself proved that this guidance and these instructions came from him through the creation account, through the story of of Noah, through the whole depiction of the Exodus, to all of the prophecies that continue to play out before us and throughout all time, and all of the historical accuracy of the depiction. He proves that he's Yahweh. And then he intervened in human history multiple times to enable the plan that he had so generously offered. And the plan is the best deal ever offered. It is a win-win scenario. Every possible benefit, the best possible benefits, are offered to us. And very little is asked of us, and what little is asked of us is actually in our interest. From someone who's in a position to do exactly what he promised, the Creator God of the universe. And you're given the opportunity to spend all eternity exploring the universe with him, being his kid, and inheriting all that he has to give. And yet, people not only ignore it, and turn it down. They reject it and mock it and oppose it. I don't know of anything sadder than that.
That's right. Yeah, look, my own kids. You know, I get invited to parties quite often, really. And, you know, they'll preface it with, you know, but you can't be talking about, you know, Yahweh and all that. Well, guess who's not going to the party?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, nobody's going to tell me
that
I have to bend to somebody else's will. I mean, I just don't understand it. I don't understand it. So you're telling me that even though I've invested a decade of my life at this point with sharing the truth, that somehow the truth just isn't good enough.
Welcome.
Somehow,
welcome.
It's a lot.
If the truth is not welcome in your home, then you either must think I'm a lie.
Well, in my home it is.
In
my home it is. It's in their home.
By the way, in Yahweh's
home. And it's not.
Yeah, and is the truth welcome in Yahweh's home?
Yeah, sure it is.
Is Yahweh's
home? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Yahweh's testimony welcome. Right. So what you're saying is that your home is the...
And I don't find this, by the way... I was talking to a person today, and I told her, you know, my four dead kids. And she, oh, don't you say that. I said, what? What do you mean, don't say it? What do you mean, don't say it? It's true. You know, people got to, you know, I didn't know what I know now when my kids were born. I learned it after they were gone.
Yeah.
Now, I'm sorry that happened. You know, and I've tried to somehow alleviate that problem. But somebody has got to clean the shit out of their ears long enough to understand that this is not a game. It's real. It's why we're here. How many people spend their stupid, foolish life wondering what's the purpose of life? Why am I here? Isn't there a real simple answer to that?
Yeah.
Isn't Yahweh's will the same for everybody? Are you out there chasing down what is Yahweh's will? His will is that you get to know him. You share his words. You share his nature with other people, that his family grows. There's nothing beyond that. What else are we doing here?
So you're selling
engines?
A more lovable, a more acceptable guy when you're part of the corruption, of the false hope that leads people to their death, deprives them of an opportunity.
No hope.
Yes, right. Well, I don't know why that's considered good and why telling people the truth and being blunt.
Well, I think you made a pretty strong statement, by the way, last week. A real strong statement. I sat and chewed on that. I'd rather be right than good.
Oh,
there you go.
Be right than good.
That's the answer.
Right.
What?
Yeah,
very
I'd
few people
right
would ever say that. But
yeah,
that is absolutely
right good.
Oh, that's right.
I'd rather be right than rich.
Yep.
I'd rather be right than win.
Yep.
I'd rather be right than almost anything else.
Oh, I don't know what's more important than being right. And so what is right when it matters? It's being Sadak. Dode was right. Was Dode good? No. Was Dode obedient? No. But Dode was right. I don't think there's many things that are more important than being right. Well, all right means is that I have correctly observed, accurately observed what Yahweh had to say. I have a accurate and correct understanding of who he is and what he's offering, and that I've responded to what he is offering and asking correctly. So that I am right in my relationship with him, and I can be upright in his presence. All of those things are derivative of being right.
Mm-hmm.
Me being good, which I would not claim to be, won't get me anywhere. Yeah, it won't get me anywhere. Being right will get me eternity with Yahweh in heaven. Being right about the terms and conditions of the covenant, being right on who Yahweh is and what he is offering and asking, gets me to be part of his family. Being good gets me nowhere. I'd rather be good than bad.
Yet that's a profound statement. That's a profound statement. I mean, it is profound. I'd rather be right than good. And you know, so much of what is viewed as good has become so convoluted anyway. I don't even know what it could possibly mean. You know, I mean, it could mean that you're accepting of all things. It could mean
you love all people. Would I rather have sterile conversations
in order to not upset the apple cart?
Would I rather be right or as rich as Bill Gates?
Go ahead, I'm sorry, I didn't...
Yeah, would you rather be right or as rich as Bill Gates?
No, you'd rather be right because you're smart.
I'd rather be right. Yeah,
you're a lot smarter than Bill Gates.
Right.
You know,
so. Would you like to be right or be president of the United States? I'd rather be right. You know,
well, you couldn't be both.
You give up your job. That's right, you couldn't be both. You can't be both, so which one do you want to be?
That's right.
Right.
I want to be right. You couldn't be the preacher of a church, could you? And be right.
How can you be certain that you're right all of the time? Because you're close.
Well, you go right to the Torah, and you stay
right in the source.
That's right.
If you go to the source of answers and you pay attention to what it says, and you apply all of the appropriate criterion to understanding what God conveyed, and you're going to be right.
You know, Elise is working on some number thing. It was an amazing thing, actually. It showed you numbers that were inside the Torah, and everything outside the Torah was 666. I mean, it's astounding. It's astounding. There's just
she develops it a little further. Yeah. No, she's going to have to share that with us.
Yes,
she will. She develops it further. And listen, I am certain that there is a number sequence, and the words that Yahweh used to convey things like light and Eretz or light, Eretz land, Torah instruction, and particularly Yahweh, his name. I'm certain that all of those things have a numerical indication that helps us better understand the universe and who Yahweh is and what he's offering. And I am certain that there's numerical sequences that are woven into the original Hebrew of the Torah, the prophets, and Psalms that help validate the fascination with numbers, with arithmetic, with, you know, the 6 + 1 = 7, you know, the equation of life and creation and salvation, and this affirmation that 6 + 1 = perfection. I'm certain that it exists all over the place, and the more you study it, the more you're going to realize it's there. So I'm not opposed to any of it. My only caution with it is that don't ever lose sight of what the words say. And overemphasize the numerical affirmations, because we already know the Torah is from Yahweh, and those things apart from it are not. And so, isn't it more important to understand what the words say and to be right in terms of your response and understanding of those words than it is to prove and know the numerical affirmations?
On that note, can I add something?
Oh, no, that's true.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
This week, we talked about Abraham being a Goyim, right? Gentile.
Right.
And we spent a lot of time on that. And I looked at these words, and I started looking up 61 Yashaya today, and 62 and 3. And I came to Gawi, or Goim, and I wrote down Gentiles, and I said, that's fine. But I decided I was going to look up all these words. So I looked up the word, and it has never hit me before on this. And it may be nothing, but to me, I thought it was pretty fascinating. The root word for Goy is G-W, Goy. It means back, or to walk back, or walk to. It's a leg, I mean, it's a foot walking. A gamel and a walk,
Uh-huh.
And the word, when you change it into goy, you add, of course, the yod or the yod.
Uh-huh.
Now think about that a minute. We're talking about the whole thing about Abraham and being a goy. His whole connection to human race was to have them walk to him, priest the family, to be with Yahweh, the one who reaches down and lifts us up.
Yes.
Why did he chose the word? We didn't choose the word. He chose that word.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being a goy. Would I rather be a Yehudim? You betcha. But this transition from being Goyim to being related to Yah is a good one.
Well, I'm not knocking that. I'm just saying, but still, he wanted everybody to walk to him to be part of his family.
Right. Including Goyim.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
we are to act like
that. That was the purpose. That was the whole point. Yahuwah was supposed to show the rest of us how to live, you know. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
That was one of the things Elise was laughing about. You know what she said? She goes, you know, I spend my whole life around Jews, and I have to walk out of Rabbinic Judaism, and who has to show me the truth? A goy.
A goy. Yeah, I know. Oh, I know.
That's just the way it goes, man.
Yeah, I know. You can almost hear it in all of the emails that she initially exchanged with me, is, you know, how is it that, you know, from most Jews' perspective, there's nothing lower than a goyim, and or goy, because it would be singular. And to have a goy be in love, literally in love, with the Torah as it's scribed in the original Hebrew, and the a goy in love with the author of the Torah, and clinging to every word of the Torah, and sharing the insights that can be gleaned from making the connections between the guidance and instructions contained in the Torah. That is a tough and bitter pill for a Yisraelite, a member of Yehuda. And while that is a tough and bitter pill for them, the realization is what Kirk just said, which is that this teaching is for all of us, and the Bereth Covenant is for all of us. And in eternity, the distinction between Goyim and Yisrael, I think, will be de minimis. So I don't think, in fact, if I were guessing, I would think that Yahweh finds humor and a dumb goyim helping a member of his family. I think that he finds humor in it the same way he found humor in picking a guy that stuttered to share his name with the world. The same way that he picked a guy who was had issues, behavioral issues, tell us how to observe the Torah. So to have this, you know, rebellious
behavioral issues.
And political,
you ought to be on some spin board.
Behavioral issues. Yeah, don't have
behavioral issues.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, boy, I think if you were to Google my name, you would find about a million links, of which 999, you know, out of every 1,000 would be critical. So, to, you know, to have a guy that people have thrown this much mud at be someone who says, you know, I'm not qualified, but I love this stuff, and I want to share with you what I've learned. I think, yeah, I find that humorous. You get a kick out of it. You know, if you can communicate powerful insights through a dumb and dirty and dim-witted implement, that makes the one wielding the implement pretty special, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it does. Yep.
Yeah. So, you know, look past.
It's like,
past the implement.
You know, an insight would be realizing exactly what you just said, that the spokesman had a thick tongue. You know, he wasn't some silver-tongued devil that was up there doing presidential debates, acting cute, making debate points. You know, I mean, he was just straight up. And that's the game, isn't it? There's one game in town. It's the only great game in town.
So when Yahusha wanted to fetch someone who that he could communicate with, who would then communicate what he said with others, who did he choose? A carpenter, some fisherman, and a tax collector?
Yeah.
Did he choose political leaders, religious leaders, the most gifted? No.
No, he didn't go down to the courthouse, and he didn't go to academia. No.
No, he didn't go to the Pentagon. He didn't go to Washington. You know, he didn't go to Wall Street. He didn't pick the rich, the gifted, the famous, the empowered. You know, he picked
the real guys.
Carpenter and
that's
some fishermen.
He did.
Yeah, real.
Yeah, people. Even the tax collector, boy, that would have been a lovely guy to choose. You know.
A guy just doing his job, and he said, "Hey, you know, would you be interested?" Yeah, this is a pretty crappy job.
I have a feeling Matanya saw a lot of evil in his job too. You know,
yeah,
I'm sure unfair.
Matanya looked at this guy and said, "Look, if I compare this guy to those guys that I'm working for, who would I rather spend time with?" Yeah, I'll do this. Sure. Yeah, count me in. You know, and here's a couple of fishermen and Shimon and Jacob and Yahuchanan. You know, out there, tough dudes, man, working hard in a tough job. And I said, hey, you know, come on. Want to really fish? Want something? Want to do something that transcends all time? Yeah, count me in. No scholars. They weren't. Didn't pick authors. Didn't. That's just his nature. You know, if you're bragging about playing an important role and serving others on behalf of God as popes and cardinals and priests and you know and megachurch pastors too, then I'm telling you, you aren't speaking for the same God. You know, you can never brag about being used by him to convey his message because he only picks flawed and dented implements. And so if the very fact that you've been picked says that you don't have any qualifications that anybody should respect. So, you know, just get out of the way and let the message come through. I love it. Exactly as it should be. You know, we don't ever, like when we began this program, somebody called you a false prophet. No, you're irrelevant. You know, who I am is wholly and completely irrelevant.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah, I'm not making prophecy.
It sure floored me. Let me tell you.
Yeah, I'm not coming up with instructions. I'm not coming up with a religion. All I'm sharing with you is what Yahweh shared, which means that not only am I right, but that I'm irrelevant. So why
but don't most false prophets want something? I mean,
yeah, sure.
They want followers, don't they, at least? Or
yeah, they want people to believe in power. Yeah, want people to believe in so they have money, power.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a route to these guys. I mean, Paul ran around talking about wanting money and how he had to rob other places to pay himself because, you know, he spent too much time teaching them.
You sold more engines or less engines because of the fact that you are in love with Yahweh and his testimony. Because you're committed to...
Well, I can only assume I've sold more because I don't work at it that hard.
It's kind of his nature. Yeah, I would agree with you. That is his nature.
You take care of my business, I'll take care of yours kind of guy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
All right, guys. Well, I've had a good time with everyone tonight. It's been a marvelous use of this time. We're going to dig further into the Obel with Yahshua 59:20 and onwards, 22 and onwards. And I'm going to cover everything that Yahshua has to say about the Obel because it's what Yahshua cited in his first public declaration. So it's rather important to make the connection between the two. And then we're going to go to Yahweh's more lengthy explanation of the Yobel and Kara Leviticus 25. I think that understanding the Yobel because of what it provides in terms of Yahweh's nature, what he's offering, what we should be conveying, and the timing of his plan, and the way that he has gone about enabling his plan, provides powerful insights, signposts on the way to being redeemed and having the Spirit be upon us and having his testimony in our mouth and us being his offspring, part of his family. So, good thing to be talking about. It's a fun subject, one that is like, Larry, I think you said.
Well, I enjoyed
the
show.
If you talk about the Yobel, most people don't have a clue what you're talking about. And
no, they don't. And the most surprising part of that, and the reason I bring it up, is because it's this constant nonsense about when he's going to return, and they're so sadly mistaken. You know, if you don't understand the Yobel, you cannot understand the timing. Yeah, period.
No.
End of discussion.
Right.
Really.
Is it possible to come up with
a Yobel? If they don't know what Yobel is, and they sit around and talk about prophecy.
Possible to understand the timing based upon the 6+1 plan as it's delineated in Barashit 1 with the creation of God. I think that alone is in the fourth day that the greater light would be visible as a moed at the time.
Yeah, right there in Barashit, the night.
How often do they blow by that? Right. But you can get there with it. But the affirmation of what's being done every 40 Yobel, but every Yobel year, and why things that are important happen on Yobel years, and then putting the connections together, it's the glue that pulls it all together. You know, it's the band that ties it all together.
Let me put it to you another way.
Yeah.
All these experts out there that are telling us that 2015, this is going to happen,
and I'm laughing,
the year 2015 is.
Or like the four blood moons that took place this past
year.
Well,
I just want to put it to you another way. How many of them have ever heard of a Yobel?
No, of course not.
Yeah.
They don't know that the year that Yahweh has set apart as essential, where he is going to return and Israel is going to be reconciled with him and with Yahudah, is year 6,000 Yah. I've got not a clue. And they don't know what 6,000 Yah is on our calendar. Not a clue, and it's all laid out. It's hard to miss if you're open to it.
Yeah, it is sad though because they affect so many people. I could care less what happens to them, but I know so many people.
I know so many people. That's why there has to be a consequence for misleading. Mm-hmm. That's why those who mislead have to bear a consequence. Sheol has to exist because if it doesn't, if those who mislead don't bear a consequence for misleading people and taking them away from Yah, then Yah's not being fair. If the moment that they're not incarcerated forever in Sheol, then Yah ceases to be jealous, loving, moral. He has to hate them. He has to expose them. He has to condemn them. He has to incarcerate them. They have to pay a consequence. It's why the third statement was etched in stone. He's not going to forgive those who diminish the importance of his name or who mislead others to lifelessness. Yeah. The Shav or Shoah system that the rabbis used to eliminate the pronunciation of his name and to misconvey his message. Right. They pick the verb that is the operative verb in the midst of the third statement, the etched in stone, and he said that is the thing, that Shoah, that's unforgivable. And they did it anyway.
That's amazing.
And then they named it Shoah.
Oh, I know, and they named it
Shoah. I was shocked.
Yeah.
You picked the wrong letters.
Yeah. and said that, you know, that our system is specifically designed to conceal, to confuse, to lead people to lifelessness. Our system is designed to deceive. And we're going to name our system the deceptive system. And, you know, you could say, and how stupid do people have to be to believe it? But that's the basis of the Masoretic. And the vocalization of the Masoretic and pretending like there aren't five vowels amongst the 22 letters in Hebrew so that the rabbis have to supply them in a system that is named deception.
So, yeah, I didn't know what a vowel is, huh?
No. Oh, yeah. We didn't
know. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That Halal said these people are so stupid. And he probably did. I mean, I know this is conjecture. Your people are so stupid. Let me tell you, I'll get them to worship me in my own name. And they do.
Right.
And they do. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you show it to them, and they don't believe it.
Yeah,
see, wait a minute. You're here on Sunday, kneeling at the foot of Halal Ben Shakar's oldest symbol, his cross, and calling him Lord.
Right.
And you don't know what you're doing yet because I've just shown you.
Right.
And oh, I'm damned to hell. Oh, how dare you use his words to condemn him and this and that. It is just bizarre. You know, I spent years looking for the truth. And here I am driving one night, and I'm going through everything I can all the time, whether it's websites or whether it's this or whether it's that. I just happen to find Yada on the radio, luckily. And there it is. And I'm going, wait a minute. I've been as had as the next guy. You know, it rang true. It was just true. It was so obvious it was true. And you were talking about steeples.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting? Because I was had too. I was right there with you.
What's that?
I was more had than you were. I was more deceived than you were. And
yeah, I know.
And wasn't embarrassed to admit it.
I know that.
You know, I wasn't presenting myself as...
Well, now you got to say I'm embarrassed. I was stupid. Yeah. So what?
But yeah. But I...
Yeah, well, at some point you got to admit
I was had
too. If you're going to be right.
That's right. I was had. But, you know, the Torah is easy to understand if you're open-minded.
Open-minded.
We chose to...
Yeah, and your understanding of the Torah was not what it is today back then. What's that?
I would say that in terms of the profound strokes of the Torah, I don't think it's changed one iota. In terms of the fine lines that provide the shading and some of the perspective, I made a bunch of mistakes, you know, like renewed covenant as opposed to the covenant's going to be renewed.
Yeah, that would be the biggest of them.
Yeah, I would think that's as big as any of them.
And, yeah, because we were saying the renewed covenant. Of course, you had to look at the renewed covenant, at least in my opinion. You had to look at it as a future event.
Right, and that's part of the messianic, you know, you come out of Christianity and then you have some affinity for... the messianic because they emphasize the Torah and the Berit Kadesh is the rallying cry of the messianics. It's always the Berit Kadesh, and so it's the renewed covenant, and so it's easy to see how you're drawn into that. You've been indoctrinated all your life with the Bible.
I want to throw something at you guys.
Mm-hmm.
But just before I get off here, I want to throw something. There's something Henry had called me, and this was something that he was discussing, and he was talking about the seven braids of Samson and so forth. And I looked up, and Samson means man of the sun. And, you know, in the final end, Samson's really tearing these pillars down, right? He's tearing these pillars down, and he doesn't just kill everybody. He kills himself as well.
Right.
You know? And I almost think, because it means man, I think he's a foreshadowing of Catholicism. I mean, I could be wrong here, but that was just one, you know, that was something I'd really like to do a study on Samson one Shabbat or two, because I think that there's a lot to be picked up there, you know, the jawbone of the ass. And, you know,
right.
That he,
you know, what does the name mean? And... So what your whole life is. The thing that I would love to do is to, we've spent a lot of time on it, which is to identify the anti-political mantra that Yahweh conveys through Shaul, King Saul, and why Yahweh says that if you choose a political leader, this is how they're going to abuse you. And then how Shaul, King Saul, becomes a metaphor for Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, and how his adversary is Dode, the person who is that tells us how to observe the Torah, and then what Shaul, King Saul, did that estranged him from Yahweh and from Yisrael and got him killed. All of that is such a profound, prophetic story that has very little to do with that particular man and has all to do with the religion that emerged as Christianity and the political systems of
the it's so funny that Sheol and Sheol, they share the same name.
And Shaul, exact course, that name is equivalent with Sheol.
Yeah, exactly.
So
Sheol,
that's one of the people that I've
the same way.
Yeah.
The only king named question. What are you doing? Why are you choosing him?
It is that Samson is man of the sun in a number of different languages. I would have to study it in Hebrew. But in Tiberian, for example, it's Simson, meaning man of the sun. And it's transliterated into a number of different languages. So it would take some studying to figure out. But I would tell you that I'm not certain that there is any name or any individual presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms that isn't symbolic or something extraordinarily important for us to understand.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would really like to get to the root of that. I really would. With the limited tools I got, I sat and looked at it as, man of the sun, but maybe that's just a bad translation.
Here's the problem with man of is that man, there's five or six Hebrew words for man, none of which are in the SH. It's actually SHMSH root. Samsung is really Shemesh, and the root is the Hebrew word for sun. So Shemesh is the Hebrew word for sun. But you don't have Adam, which would be man, Ish, which is individual, Enosh, which is mortal. The Hebrew words for man are not part of it. So but the sun is absolutely, unequivocally true. So M means sun, but not sun in the sense of S-O-N, sun in the sense of S-U-N.
Yeah, sun, S-U-N, sure.
Yeah. Sun, which is the...
I would like to see a breakdown, I'm sorry.
Yeah, so... What you would have here is there are the sun can represent the greater light who becomes visible to us and therefore is a positive sort of or it can represent the false gods that are worshipped on Sundays as lords and halal bin shakar the arrogant one who is the son of the son, and who tries to present himself as the son in the guise of God. And so it's one of those things that is used both ways. And so Shemesh can refer to the positive aspects of the sun, of brilliant light, of warmth, of providing nourishment and all the positives of the sun. But it can also...
It just didn't want to go, by the way. So, yeah.
Yeah, sure.
But, I understand that. I look at the overall story, even when I saw his hair regrowing,
mm-hmm.
I felt like that was a covering over. Not I'm back with you, but kind of a clouding of the issue. I'm covering, I have a new covering now, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I just see it kind of that way, and in the end, it's all destruction. I just don't see it as being, you know, affiliated with the other one. You know, it'd be great if I'd be wrong, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I'm all set. We can talk about it in one of our future programs, is what the name represents and what he represents and what his story tells us that is important for us to understand. Because clearly with Yahweh, one does not lose their influence and power with Yahweh by going to the barber.
Probably not.
Well, that's true, too.
Yes. So our power with Yahweh.
He began to associate with what was bad. You know.
Yes, and then began to fear that a physical one aspect of his physical manifestation, if altered, would somehow alter his strength, and that's not godly.
But I'd like to see your take on the whole story.
Okay.
You know, I really would. You know, and you're right. I like that. Yeah. You know, one trip to the barber.
Exactly. Yeah, if I get a bad haircut, I'm going to tell you, I don't come out any different. I might not, probably don't look so hot, but, you know, I didn't look so hot when I walked in. But it has absolutely no influence. You know, and, you know, even Doe, when Doe is referring to how many things, how many flaws he has, did he refer to his flaws as his hair? Right?
No.
Yep. So, there may be a tool there to help understand, Samson's fascination with his hair. First, I don't think that when we fixate on any aspect of our physical nature that we're doing something that is consistent with Yahweh's testimony. Well, I don't have any issue. I think the physical aspect of our bodies is something Yahweh created and loves and is good, but we ought not take pride in or rely upon any aspect of our physical nature. That's going to lead us into a bad situation, and that's really the story of Samson. He lost confidence when an aspect of his physical nature was changed. And that shows that you are disconnected from a proper understanding of who Yahweh is and what he's offering and what he's doing on our behalf. All right. Well, anyway, it's been we've got lots to consider, and I promise I'll do my best to share some insights on that when we next gather.
Okay.
Good night, fellas.
Good night.
Okay.
Right. Good night.
All right. Thanks. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night, Jim. Good night.